This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I go back and forth myself between pessimism and optimism, and usually I think I'm somewhere in the middle. I think we have probably one of the greatest generational tasks ever put on any human generation. This is comparable to me to World War II, to the fight against nuclear proliferation. But at the same time, I don't think it's hopeless.
How do you usually react to the stream of dire warnings about climate change and wildlife extinction? Does it motivate you to do more to make a difference? Or does it submerge you into depressed inertia? This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with environmental journalist Jeremy Hance about his ongoing series for Manga Bay, which shines an encouraging light on the future of our planet's flora and fauna. Hance outlines the bottleneck to breakthrough theory and looks at the driving factors that may save our species and others from extinction. Who knew that Earth science prognostications could actually serve as an antidote to climate change malaise? I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Jeremy Hance. He's a freelance environmental journalist, and he is a contributor to Manga Bay. Jeremy, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be back.
So you have an impressive series that you've been writing for Manga Bay called The View from the Bottleneck, and I wanted to explore it a little deeper today. First, what inspired the piece, and maybe outline the thesis if you can.
Sure. Well, the inspiration is really a paper that came out last year by three remarkable scientists from the Wildlife Conservation Society. And I stumbled on this paper and I was like, whoa, this is pretty interesting. It was putting together a lot of ideas that I think have been bandied about, but it was putting it together in a really elegant way, I thought. And it was creating an argument for, I think, more positive thinking, but not an argument that like, hey, we should just, you know, do nothing and just twiddle our thumbs, but an argument that like there are certain large scale macro drivers going on in the world right now that if they continue in the same direction and if they kind of become more and more increasingly global, that could really shape the world and change the world for better, both in terms of nature, but also in terms of sort of global society. And I think, you know, we live in a time where there's a lot of negativity and there's a lot of frustration at the pace of change. And I understand that. And I feel that all the time in my work and in our kind of our current political climate around the world. So it was just really interesting and refreshing. And just what the authors are really describing is not something that we're going to see like in the next 10 years or 20 years. I mean, we can continue to watch these drivers and these macro scale things change, but really they're talking about a time scale of 100 and 200 years. And I think as human beings, we have a really hard time wrapping our minds around that. But it was a really interesting exercise in trying to do that and take and go on this journey with them. And so that was the inspiration for the piece.
Yes, sometimes when we look at these longer time scales and how it compares in the thread of human history, we all often look at it through a more dire lens. You ask the question in the title of The View from the Bottleneck, is nature poised for a big comeback? So after diving into this subject, what's the short answer in your estimation?
So is nature poised for a big comeback? I mean, I think that title is a little, it's kind of a fun title. I was kind of playing with that idea of timescale and the word poised. It makes it sound like, again, like this is just going to happen tomorrow. But the whole idea of the argument is that this is on long timescales. And nature doesn't live in the generational scheme of humanity. You know, like there are trees and living organisms on the earth that have been around a lot longer than, you know, the industrialized world have. So nature doesn't really just subsist in this one time frame. So I kind of wanted to think about that in the idea of, okay, yeah, I mean, I do think that what we see is that there are places in the world that where nature is kind of making these mini comebacks, where there are these really happy stories happening about species being rewilded, about new protected areas being created and reconnected, and species that we thought were extinct that are actually found, and you know, and so these are these kind of these little happy stories in this blip of this really depressing bad news about biodiversity loss, about climate change, about ecological destruction. And so I think I'm taking from the authors is that, you know, there are these places where these things are happening, and perhaps if these, you know, certain things continue in certain directions, which is namely population, fertility decline around the world, which is the end of poverty around the world, and urbanization, if those kind of continue in the way that these authors are describing, then perhaps what we could see is a resurgence of the natural world in 100, 200 years on a global scale, instead of being on this sort of, you know, small scale of certain places and certain happy stories, on a more global scale of human population decline. And by decline, I mean the numbers of people, not that the quality of life would go down. And in fact, I think it would inversely go up, but that we would have fewer and fewer people living on the planet. And conversely, nature would make this comeback where, you know, wild animals would take over areas they hadn't been seen for a long time, where we could rewild and where we could have greater abundance of species. And we see this in the story of, for example, I think one of the best stories is the story of whales and around the world. Once we stopped whaling, we now have populations of whales that would have been unimaginable in the 1960s and 1970s. Just absolutely mind-boggling that we have as many humpback whales as we do now. But that's because we stopped doing a certain thing and it allowed those animals to jump back. And not to say that there aren't a lot of whales that are still gravely endangered, and not to say that whales aren't facing threats, but we can see these comeback stories when you give nature a little space. And so what they're describing is sort of a mass globalization of this sort of comeback story, which from an environmentalist journalist point of view was a really interesting idea and something I really wanted to tackle.
So you spoke to two people from the Wildlife Conservation Society, the WCS, and they incorporate this bottleneck to breakthrough theory into their daily work. That's unexpected in a lot of ways. You always think of these wildlife nonprofits going out there to the most remote parts on the earth, but they're actually focusing their efforts more on urban areas than ever before. Do you see this being a trend, and maybe explain kind of what impact a WCS can have on an urban area?
Sure. I mean, I think it's really interesting. That was one of the reasons why this idea grabbed me, is because they were actually incorporating this theory into their work and the organization as a whole, which is hundreds, maybe even thousands of employees around the world, dozens of programs in various countries around the world of wildlife. They're sort of incorporating this idea that as the globe urbanizes, as fertility rates drop, as the human population stabilizes and hopefully eventually will start to decline, that we can make space for wildlife again. And so there's a number of different ways that you can kind of help this along. And one is working in newly emerging urban areas in developing countries and trying to get people there excited about their wildlife heritage. As they become entering into the middle class, they might be able to give more thought to the nature, to wildlife, to conservation. Other areas are just basically what they kind of describe as a policy of holding on, of setting aside protected areas in countries where this transition is going on and saying we need to preserve this area and we need to preserve the wildlife in it because in 100 years, it could make a comeback. Just like we're seeing in parts of the western U.S. where grizzly bears are making comebacks, the population's growing, where wolves have been making comebacks in throughout Europe and the U.S. again.
Bald eagles,
yeah, is a great example. The California condor, which was down to like 15 animals now, is, you know, we have all these stories of these animals that have made these comebacks in especially in sort of advanced economies. And what they're saying is we can do the same thing in developing nations once these nations sort of get through their early stage development of rapid economic growth, of sort of a kind of destruction of nature in order to fuel that growth, but eventually that will stabilize. This is the argument that they make, and it will turn into a more advanced economy, and the population will shift. There'll be fewer children, and there'll be, you know, the population will sort of stabilize at a more sane rate, and we can then start to talk about bringing things back. But before you can bring things back, you have to obviously hold on and keep some of those places and some of those wildlife species intact so that you have something to bring back from.
Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, don't grumble, give a whistle. And this'll help things turn out for the best. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing.
Always look on.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to journalist Jeremy Hantz. So, Jeremy, when we're talking about population falling, and there's some projections that see global population falling to 2.3 billion, as low as 2.3 billion by the year 2300. I mean, that's kind of hard to really look 250 years into the future like this, but that would be a third of the current global population. That would mean a lot for biodiversity and wildlife sustainability in many ways. Maybe I missed it, but I wanted to get your thoughts on when we're talking about this lowered population, is that merely from the good side of population control and in terms of women's rights and education around the globe, and maybe lowering of religiosity where there's more access to contraception and more understanding of what it means to have a larger family in terms of carbon footprint? Or does climate change come into that calculus? We often hear how rising sea levels will mean wiping out cities and populations of some of the most vulnerable people. So this isn't necessarily such a good thing if we're keeping that in mind. Is climate change part of that calculus?
I don't believe it is. So they're taking this projection actually from projections from the UN. So the UN puts out this range of what the population could look like. So, you know, we could have, by the end of this century, we could have, you know, we could see a peak of our population and then it'll start to decline. Or we could see 14 billion people on the planet, you know, double what we have today. So it really depends on how you look at the numbers that are going on around the world and what you think is going to happen. And to put the 2.3 billion number into context, so the world actually hit 2 billion people as recently as 1927. So 2.3 billion people, it's so much smaller than the amount of people we have today, but it's still a lot of people. You know, if you think about the 1930s, 1940s, that was less than 3 billion people on the Earth. So still a lot of people, still a lot of a rich, diverse society. But they're not taking climate change into account, I think largely because it's such a wild card. And the other problem with population, trying to figure out population growth, is the key here is not so much, you know, could there be a natural disaster here and there, or could there be an epidemic here or there? The key is really that if women are educated and women are granted certain rights, you know, over their fertility and over the family they want to have, and at the same time children are surviving childhood, then the population goes down. So when you reduce infant mortality, for example, all of a sudden people are having smaller families because they're not worried that the one or two children they have are not going to make it to 18. You know, people will have 7 kids if they think that 3 or 4 of them are going to die before they reach the age of 5, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's really about improving overall human welfare.
To put it another way, how does having less extreme poverty help save some of these species?
Yeah, so this is where things start to get tricky. And I think there's been some very interesting debate about this, and I think the answer is still not exactly out. At least I would say there's a lot of contention around this idea. But the idea, I think what the authors are putting forward is that ending extreme poverty improves human welfare, which in turn improves the fact that we're going to have fewer children, right? And so over time, fewer children means less humans, means helping wildlife. It can also mean a less direct – so people who are extremely poor are often living – and I've seen this in my travels around the world – are often living directly off of nature in the sense that you go to a place where there's a national park and you'll have, you know, very poor people living squatting inside the park, burning down the forest to grow food. You know, that's a very classic example of poverty directly on nature. And it's harder to regulate that because of the poverty. It's harder to deal with that because of these sort of systematic issues and social issues. But I think the other argument you could make, as well, as people get, you know, as people come out of poverty, they get richer, they're going to spend more, they're going to consume more overall. And that's where there's sort of this difficult crux, right, of can we get to a point where we start to decouple our economic growth from direct consumption on natural resources? And that's tricky. And I don't know, you know, I think the authors would say, the researchers on this paper would say, yes, we can. I'm maybe a little bit more skeptical of that. I'm a little more, I think we need sort of a cultural revolution around materialism and around consumption. And I think we need our world leaders to act more, you know, to be just less about, you know, saying sustainability and actually meaning sustainability. But I think that that's kind of there's a tension there of trying to figure out how that can work.
The reason I ask is that, yes, of course we want extreme poverty to end for many reasons, but just wondering how it would impact future wildlife. I can see people being less desperate for poaching and things like that, but that I'm assuming that's not a big part of it. As you mentioned, if you are in a better financial state, you have a better chance of your babies surviving, so you don't have as many. That's why I asked if it's a function of the population projections or not.
I think it's both those things. I think a lot of, you know, a lot of what you see within poaching and sort of nature destruction on a really in very poor countries is partly a product of poverty, right? Like people are having to go out there and kill a rhino in order to try and send their kids to school, mm-hmm. right? Like their desperate poverty is producing this. Now, if people did not have to do that to send their kids to school, they wouldn't go out there and kill those rhinos because it's not really – it's dangerous. It's horrible work. You know, people don't choose to do that kind of stuff. And the same goes with small-scale poaching, whether it's pangolins or birds. You know, like it doesn't – but then you have the flip side where, you know, the rising middle classes in the developing world and obviously in the advanced world too – then you have the flip side of there's rising consumption and there's often demand for other things, and they're the ones producing demand. So it's trying to thread that needle, I think. But I can imagine a world of 2.3 billion, which is one of the projections that we discussed, you know, in which people are no one's desperately poor anymore. And at the same time, maybe we've culturally changed to view nature differently in a way that's really maybe even hard for some of us to wrap our minds around now as we're living in sort of this post-enlightenment industrial age still that's obsessed with economic growth. Maybe we've changed that mindset enough where those 2.3 billion people are living pretty high welfare standards, you know, and at the same time nature is really thriving to provide for that human population, but also just on its own terms is thriving. And so I think that that's kind of the beautiful picture at the end of this, but we can't just get there by doing nothing. That would require some large-scale changes throughout the next few decades and beyond.
I haven't read the full study, but did you come across any calculus for lab-grown meat and protein, which it could be a promising turn of events for not just wildlife, but domesticated animals? And our whole ecosystem could benefit from not having to eat all these animals.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, one of the biggest impacts we have as individuals is really the decision to eat meat, especially things like beef, right? And so they didn't really put that in there, but they do talk a little bit, you know, and into this conversation I had with them, you know, there was a discussion of, well, what is the world technology going to look like in 200 years? Let's say that we get through this climate crisis. Let's say that, you know, our technology kind of continues to expand. you know, we can't even wrap our minds around, like, how will we be producing energy, and how will we be producing food might be very different than what we do now. And probably, again, if we look at sort of the history of the last few hundred years, probably much more efficient. So yes, I think that kind of is in the back of their minds. It isn't necessarily something that's going to be driven into the paper, because again, it's sort of speculation, but I think, you know, the rise of vegetarianism and veganism becoming more and more popular, and becoming more of a political force, I think is a very hopeful sign that maybe we can shift our culture in a way that allows us to sort of get through this global bottleneck and leave something, for our children's children's children.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking with journalist Jeremy Hance. So, Jeremy, from a radio listener's standpoint, it's a welcome change from the terrible news we're inundated with, to hear that, yes, there is a great chance for some of these animals we cherish to make a vital comeback. But from a policymaker standpoint, should we be looking at it much more from a scarcity standpoint or not?
I think honestly we have to do a little bit of both. Like I get really tired of people, you know, on social media who are just always like, oh, the humans are the worst things ever, and we've destroyed the earth, and it's all over. And I'm like, I have an 8-year-old. You know, if it's all over, this is ridiculous. Like, it's not over. I go back and forth myself between pessimism and optimism, and usually I think I'm somewhere in the middle. I think we have probably one of the greatest generational tasks ever put on any human generation. This is comparable to me to World War II, to the fight against nuclear proliferation. But at the same time, I don't think it's hopeless. I really don't. And I've been doing this for 10 years, and I've been writing about some really horrible environmental dire things. And I've been to places in the world that do, on the face of it, look pretty dark. But you also get these happy stories, and I've seen these happy stories, and you know, when you understand some of these drivers, I think the point is that we need to take more action, much more aggressive action. We need to be much bolder. But I think in order to do that, you have to have some kind of feeling that you can, you know, that the world can be different than it is, and that it's not just over. So I think you have to be totally realistic about the challenges. But you also have to be realistic about the sense that, like, we don't know what the world's going to look like in 200 years. We really don't. I mean, I try to think about this in the sense of, if I was living in 1819, which is 200 years ago, how could I have predicted that, you know, humans would have gotten to the moon, and that, you know, that all the things that have happened since then, that there would be movies and television. I mean, and not just technology, but cultural revolutions, that there would be that old colonies would fall away, that all the political marks of that era would sort of fade and be crushed and be born anew. Like, we don't know what the world's going to look like in 200 years. But I think what we have to try and do is be realistic about the challenges that we are facing right now, and do it with an eye that to know that if we can meet those challenges, we can make the world, at least give future generations a better chance of living happy lives with a robust, abundant, natural world still intact. And I think that's totally possible. I don't think that's a dream or totally unrealistic, but I don't think it's going to be easy either. Like, I think we have to stand down and face some of these challenges that we're seeing today. And I would put probably two of them at the top would be climate change and overpopulation. And, you know, and those are connected, and we don't talk about that very often, but, you know, the fact that we continue to have this growing, booming population, combined with the fact that our, you know, carbon emissions continue to go up, that's intimately connected. So I think any way that we can push, which is educating women, giving women rights, which is ending poverty, which is vaccinating children, you know, any way that we can do these kinds of things, I think can lead to a better world.
Yes, I mean, it comes down to what we do with these predictions. I've talked to environmentalists in Costa Rica who are doing amazing work, but they're also big followers of the writings of futurist James Howard Kunstler, who's extremely pessimistic about the future of humanity. But, you know, they've taken his dire warnings as a sign to do more. What we can be assured of, though, is that if you become cynical from some of the more dire predictions and do nothing, then that cynicism really will ultimately just be a self-fulfilling prophecy, right?
Yeah, I think that that's really true. And I think it's really hard because, I mean, I you know, a lot of this, the changes we need to make are not at the individual scale. They're at the societal and at the leadership and political scale. And so that can get very frustrating. And I understand the cynicism to a certain extent. But yeah, living in cynicism, it's not going to get anybody anywhere. And it's not going to convince people that they should listen to you when you give them realistic arguments about what's going on, because they don't want to listen to someone who just says it's all over. What's the point then? So, you know, and I think that cynicism is become kind of a toxic force in the environmental and conservation world. And I understand it, but I do think that, like, and I'm not saying we should go the other way and be Pollyanna-ish about any of this or pretend that, like, somehow these larger drivers that these scientists have pinpointed are somehow going to just save us. That's ridiculous. But I think it should give us more means to act and to think and to try and persuade, really, which is what we probably need to be doing most of all, is persuading people that these are large-scale problems like climate change, like mass extinction, that we need to do much more as a global society, not just as individuals, to counteract.
Well, it's a terrific piece you've written, and you're doing great work at Manga Bay and elsewhere. I appreciate the conversation as always. Jeremy Hance, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Fela Kuti, Monty Python, and Rusty Kershaw. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.